We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
From inside Camp Randall Stadium, Learfield IMG College presents Behind the Badgers, an exclusive look inside Wisconsin athletics. Here are your hosts, Patrick Herb and Brian Mason.
Thanks for checking out Behind the Badgers podcast. I'm Patrick Herb. With me is Brian Mason.
Normally, this is the point in the podcast where you and I sort of go back and forth on some topical items, but
not today.
Not today. I mean, we just finished up with Mark Johnson, head coach of the Wisconsin women's hockey team, hero of the Miracle on Ice 1980 U.S. hockey team, and there is so much good stuff to get to. Let's just jump right into our conversation with Mark.
Yeah, he covers amazing stories from 40 years ago. It's the 40th anniversary of the Miracle on Ice, so what better way to honor that than to bring in one of the heroes of it? He's also the women's hockey coach here at Wisconsin. They've got a big weekend ahead. They need 3 points this weekend against Minnesota Duluth to clinch the WCHA title as a share of it. 4 points gives them the outright title. We cover that, and then we go almost an hour long on the Miracle on Ice and Story Hour with Mark Johnson.
It's worth your time.
It's incredible. Here he is, Magic Mark. Really excited and thankful that you were able to give us some time today for our podcast. Before we get into any storytelling, I want to look back at last weekend because that seemed really special for your program. The Fill the Bowl in the Kohl Center, having 14,000 people. Can you talk about what that means for your program to be able to pack the Kohl Center for a women's hockey game?
Well, I find it extremely meaningful for our student athletes, just for the experiences that they can acquire here in Madison, being part of not only the university, being part of the campus, but more importantly, being part of our program. And so what special things can we do? So, you know, when they graduate and they're 4, 5, 8, 10, 15 years away from us and they reflect back on their memories, what are going to be their highlights? Obviously, when you win some championships or you're part of those special teams, those are going to stick out. But I think more importantly, you know, those nights or afternoons that we had Sunday are special because we don't see those big attendances. Obviously, at LeBron, we sell out quite regularly, but when we're on the road, we don't see a lot of big crowds. For them to get a chance to go on the ice and do that, you know, if I'm a parent, and I was a parent at one time when my daughter was out there, we played Minnesota and we got a packed house. It's just exciting. It's a big thrill, and it's something that we can give our student athletes that is extremely special. So,
what did Ohio State coach say to you about it? Because he must have been like, this is unbelievable. You've seen it before, but they probably had never seen anything like that.
No, I mean, you know, both teams, it's an exciting part. You know, when we're shaking hands after the game Sunday afternoon, you could see the excitement in the players and thanking us for giving them the same type of experience. So a lot of teams like to come into Madison and play, whether we're over at LeBron or, you know, every few years get a chance to play at the Kohl Center. So it's an afternoon that, you know, our fans are willing to support our program and come out and, you know, show their support and just provide an opportunity to our athletes that is unmatched.
I mean, you alluded to it, but your usual home ice advantage is pretty darn special over here, too, at Laban. Where does this place stack up where all the travels you guys go around the country, and what having a place like this where 3,000 people are going to show up for a game, what does that mean to the sport and to your team?
Well, it just shows that, you know, if the product is exciting, there's energy within it. Obviously, when you win, it helps grow that sport quite quickly. And, you know, we've had quite a bit of success, you know, the last 8 or 10 years. And just a little bit. And so I remember when my dad first came to Madison and, you know, hockey wasn't really on the map here. And, you know, he would travel around, go to different Kiwanis clubs, go to any kind of banquet he could get his foot in the door on. And, you know, when he was talking to those groups of people, he would just challenge them, hey, come to the game. You know, buy a ticket, see if you like the game. If you don't like the game, you don't have to come back. Nothing lost. But if you like it, you know, all of a sudden, you know, 10 people, 20 people, 100 people, and all of a sudden you got something special because you've put a product on the ice that people want to come out and support and enjoy watching, and they're entertained.
That's crazy to me to think about a time when Madison, when hockey wasn't on the map in Madison, because right. Now, I mean, you've got 50 years of history of this place being a pretty special place for the game.
Well, you guys amazing. Are young enough. Yeah, you don't remember my dad first came in the middle 60s, they were playing over at Hartmeyer.
Oh,
and, you know, I spent the first couple of years at Hartmeyer, and obviously, you know, you probably can get maybe 2,000, maybe 2,500 if you really cram people in over there. And all of a sudden, you know, the Coliseum and now the Alliant Energy Center was built in the late 60s. And at that time, everybody thought they were crazy. There's no way you're going to get that many people to watch a hockey game. And so as time went on, especially in the early 70s, where all of a sudden you had season ticket holders for Friday night, and then you had another group of season ticket holders for Saturday night. So you had a lot of people that were excited about hockey in the early 70s. In 72, they went to the NCAA tournament. And then 73, they won the NCAA tournament. And so then started, you know, a relationship between our community and the University of Wisconsin hockey program that's been special, as you mentioned, for so long now. And then when the women, you know, decided to come on board and the athletic department approved having a women's hockey team. I remember in the first couple of years, it was, you know, the same type of thing, trying to get people to understand what it looks like, try to get them out to see a game. And I'll never forget when I first started, I think it was my second year, trying to figure out how can we, you know, get our games on campus. Because when I first started on the women's program, we were playing out at the Cap Ice Center. We were playing some of our
players. Verona, some, right, too?
And some in Verona. And so one thing about hockey fans, they like consistency. And so, you know, we needed to come down on campus. And so we started our playing games at the Kohl Center. And obviously, it's quite large. And, you know, I remember sitting by the Zamboni door one game and saying, boy, wouldn't it be cool if we get one opportunity in one game where we could fill this place and have our student athletes experience it. And over the course of time, we've been able to do it a couple times. And those are just special moments. And so Sunday was a great tribute to not only our police force, you know, our paramedics and our firefighters, our veterans. And so the whole way our event management people put that presentation prior to us dropping the first puck just made the day really, really special.
Well, there's a special connection for you that's not just something that we do to, you know, we honor military veterans at football games and stuff, but this had a special connection for you, did it not?
It did. I mean, you know, my son's a firefighter and now a paramedic. And so, you know, we're in touch with a lot of his coworkers and, you know, realize what sacrifices they do. And, you know, without, you know, their jobs and the way they're able to do their jobs, our community would be certainly not as safe as it is now. And so you don't realize it until all of a sudden there's an emergency with either you or one of your family members or somebody close to you. And all of a sudden it's like, what happened? Oh, well, we had, you know, we called 911 and here comes the, you know, the paramedics. And all of a sudden they saved my child, my son, my daughter, life because they got here so quick. So, it's something that I've, the community that they're able to put together, the firefighters and the police officers and the veterans, you know, I can see why people are attracted to it, especially people that grow up playing sports. So you're going into this community, so a community of firefighters, a community of police officers, and they look after one another, they take care of one another's, they're very supportive, and they're very giving people. And so, to show our appreciation in a 3 or 4 minute window on Sunday afternoon probably wasn't enough, but even that little bit was good.
Well, I saw you wearing the firefighter jacket. How heavy was that jacket? Because it looked like it.
Well, two things. One, I remember, I don't know if I was 6, 7, or 8, somewhere, you know, and I had a fire truck and I always wanted to be a fireman. And so for Sunday afternoon for 2.5 hours, I got to be a fireman. When I finally took it off at the end of the game and I was going to my car, my back was sore because it is extremely heavy. And then you figure out, you know, their helmets are very heavy. And then they put, if they have, you know, oxygen tanks on the back, you need to be in pretty good shape and physically strong enough to carry that stuff around.
Some new respect for those guys.
Yeah, and if people haven't yet, Andy Baggett wrote a great story on UWBadgers.com that kind of goes into the depth about all the different former student athletes here that have gone on to, whether it's police, paramedics, firefighters. It's pretty cool. There's a deep connection.
Talking about your current team, like switching gears a little bit. So Kristen Campbell seems like the latest in terrific goaltenders that we've had here in this program. I don't like comparing players to others because it's not necessarily fair either way, but does she not get the credit she deserves because she's just the latest great hockey goalie that we've had?
No, I think, last year she certainly got recognized, and I think she and a lot of other people.
MVP of the national championship.
Yep. Yep. And, I think back on Jessie Vetter and what she did over her course of her time and, you know, that first run we have to win our first national championship, very similar to what Kristen did. They get dialed in. They really get focused in that last couple weeks of the season. And as I've always said, if you have a good goaltender, they can make good coaches pretty quick, especially if they're stopping pucks like they did. And so, it's a simple formula. The last 2 or 3 games, if you don't let any goals in, your chances of winning are pretty good. And so Jesse took that to heart and, had a few shutouts late in the season and we won a national championship. And Kristen did the same thing last year. I mean, it's challenging to do because you're playing against the best teams in the country on each given night. And, it's a unique position, especially in our sport where there's so much pressure on the goaltender. And if she has a good night, I don't care who you're playing, where you're playing. If the other team's goalie or your goaltender plays well, it really gives that team an opportunity to win. And Kristen's been able to do that in almost every game she's played for us.
Yeah.
Now, on the other end of the ice, I was here a couple of weeks ago for a game where you guys scored 10. So you've got some offensive firepower, too. Who should people know about that are putting the puck in the net for you guys?
Well, I mean, Darryl Watts, who transferred over from BC this year, won the, Patty Kazmaier her freshman year, which is, probably one of the rare feats you'll ever see.
Patty Kazmaier is basically the Heisman of women's hockey.
Yep, so not many freshmen are going to, put up the numbers or gather the attention that she was able to do and won the award. And so, she transferred over and, has a great skill set, has the ability to get pucks in the net, has great vision. I call it great hockey IQ, just understands the game really well on a deeper level than maybe a lot of other players. And so she's had a great year. She's been very consistent. Her adjustment into not only campus life here in Madison, academic life within our student athletes, but, on the ice, she's adapted extremely well and been a lot of fun to watch. And I think she's grown over the course of her season here, which is, the utmost importance to all of us. We want to, continue to see our players get better. And so, she's got one person you're going to notice quite a bit. And I think, one of our leaders, Abby Rocks, putting up an outstanding year, has had an outstanding career for us. Scored probably more goals this year than the last couple of years combined. So it's fun to watch her. And, Sophia Shirley's having a breakout year. So those three players early on in the season played online with us and really gave the other team fits as far as, who do you cover, how do you cover them. If I've got one or two, well, there's the third one that's open up, and here goes a puck in the back of the net. So the one thing about our sport is if you have some depth, especially in scoring, generally you're going to be pretty successful over the course of the winter.
So final regular season series this weekend, you guys go to Duluth. Big opportunity for the team. I heard you talk in the press conference this week about learning from last year's kind of a similar scenario. Can you kind of expound what you meant by that, that last year you had an opportunity against Ohio State and maybe it triggered what happened the rest of the year?
Yeah, we had a chance to clinch our league championship here in Madison, with our last weekend against Ohio State last season. Ended up tying both games. Lost them in shootouts. And so instead of gathering 3 points or 2 points with a win in shootout, you know, you end up only getting one. And so the combination of that and what Minnesota had done that weekend, you know, we lost the opportunity to have that championship. And, you know, it's a bitter pill to swallow because, you know, as I've told the team, you know, their season usually starts in the middle of June when they come back for summer school and start doing their off ice, doing a lot of different things to get themselves ready for the season. So it's a long, grinding season. And yeah. To have it so close and your ability to almost touch it and grab it and pull it in here, and then it's taken away. But, you know, in the bigger picture, sometimes a little bit of pain or a little disappointment or when something's pulled away that you know you're so close to can springboard into something that's special. And I know when we got back, you know, the following weekend on a Monday, you know, had a good meeting with the team, got them to understand that, yeah, this slipped away, but, you know, here's the next part of the season as far as playoffs. And if we had won the regular season championship, we would have had to play the, you know, we wouldn't have played the next weekend. We would have had that weekend off. And so by losing it, we had to play. And that was the best thing for us. You know, we came into that series, the first round of the playoffs, sort of notched it up another level. And if you're going to win, you know, an NCAA championship, you know, you get into that mindset, you have to go up another level. You might have had a great regular season, but then you got to keep climbing the ladder as far as how you're playing. And I think having played that weekend, that really helped us. And then we went into our, you know, final face-off, faced, again, Ohio State with, you know, tough games and close games. We ended up winning that one and then played Minnesota for our league playoff championship in their building and ended up beating them. And then, you know, moving on to our quarterfinal game, and then we got to the NCAA tournament, and then we get Minnesota in the championship game. But, you know, again, as a coach, you're looking at how you're practicing, how you're performing at that time, and I think for our staff, you know, we were comfortable. You know, we just needed to go out, manage our nerves, and execute, and felt very confident that we were capable of winning that last game against Minnesota, and we were able to get through that. And, you know, having that experience a couple weeks previous, as you look back on it, was probably the best thing that happened to us, even though it was a little bit painful. And I remember coming to, you know, practice Monday, and it just eats away at you that, you know, you have something that you've worked so hard for, and it slips away. And, you know, you credit Ohio State, you credit Minnesota. They just did a little bit more than we needed to do to win that league championship.
So that's coming up this weekend. The other thing that's happening this weekend is the 40th anniversary of the Miracle on Ice. So we got to talk about that some. Do you get tired of talking about it? I mean, I know it's you're super proud of it, but do you get tired of that? Because I'm sure you've been asked the same questions a million times.
I don't think any of us, you know, get tired of it, because usually the people that are asking the questions or, you know, wanting some stories or information are smiling like you are right now. You know, your eyes are
on us.
You must have had a big, high-octane cup of coffee this morning. Your eyes are perked up and there's excitement in your face. And I know the stories. I know the experiences that we had as players, but somebody that's asking it, you know, it may be the first time that they're getting a chance to converse with one of the players or people that were there.
So let me set this up. So I have two boys.
It's been a busy 2.5 weeks.
Oh, I bet.
I was telling my son this morning, I had dropped my car off to get fixed. So he was driving home and he was talking about different interviews. And I says, well, this afternoon I could probably do 8-9 interviews instantly with the New Jersey Devils, Tampa Bay, Nashville Predator. I mean, you just go down the list of people. So it's a busy time of year, but that's okay.
And it sort of speaks to how that moment and that team sort of transcended for so many different people, that there's a connection there that so many people want to talk about.
Well, I was going to say, I have two boys that are 7 and 9 years old. And so I mean, that was a million years ago. They don't even understand what that was. So we watched Miracle on Sunday night. I said, boys, this is our time. We got to watch this. And I've seen the movie before and I know a lot of the stories, but watching them watch it, and they asked me questions about it, and we're talking about it as we watch it, was kind of like a rite of passage almost, to teach my kids, who are now three generations removed from it, about this incredible sequence of events. And so I was like, this is time, boys, we got to watch this. And because I told them, I said, we're going to be talking with one of the guys who played on the team this week on our podcast. And they were really excited about that. And that's sort of the legacy, you know, that now three generations removed, that you guys have established. Do you get goosebumps still thinking about things, or have you numbed a little bit?
I always get worried that when I watch highlights from the Russian game that we don't win. It's all been a big, you know, nightmare that we've lived for so long. But, no, I mean, there's, you know, things. I mean, a couple weeks ago, Mike Rizzioni and Jim Craig and myself, we flew out to ESPN Studios. And with Jeremy Schapp, we sat down and watched the entire game and did what we're doing right now in front of this gigantic screen. Huh. And we would stop it at different points in the game, and Jeremy would ask us questions, what you're thinking, what's going on. And so it was one of the few times I think I've actually sat down and watched the entire game. And, you know, you look back on it, and, you know, a lot of positive things and a lot of things that kept their momentum going happened within that game, but also happened throughout the entire Olympic experience that we had as a team, and, you know, really springboard us into that, you know, final couple games to really do something special. We had no idea what we were doing other than for all of us, we were fulfilling a dream. And, you know, back then, you know, one of the great thrills any athlete could acquire was an opportunity to play on their, you know, their country's Olympic team. And things have changed within the Olympic structure now because professionals have been added, professional teams and professional players are all participating. And so it's got a little different flavor to it, but we're always you're seeing the best players. Back then it was different because, you know, you had communist countries with Czechoslovakia and Russia, you know, that were really in the army. They were in the army, and their job in the army was to be hockey players. And so, you know, the Russians would live in barracks 11 months out of the year. They would practice 3 or 4 times a day. And the way they would, you know, show strength within their structure and their country was to go out and win. And so they would go to world championships. They would go to Olympics, and they would come away with gold medals and, you know, be proud of what they were able to accomplish and, you know, be proud of the way they were raised and their values as a country. So for us, we were just fulfilling a dream. I mean, how cool would it be to make the, you know, 1980 Olympic team? You know, we're hosting it. It's in Lake Placid, New York, and you might be one of the 20 players that we're going to get a chance to, you know, wear the jersey. And, you know, for me, I was part of the 76 Olympic team with my dad coaching it. Ended up getting cut one Sunday evening at dinner, but it was an experience that you know, really, you know, in the back of my mind planted a seed that, you know, the next go around 1980, I wanted to do whatever I could do to, you know, be part of that group. Just seeing the experience my dad had with his journey to Innsbruck in 1976.
You know, I think, and deservedly so, the miracle game itself is what so many people fixate on. But you alluded to it. It was this much larger experience for you and your teammates and the coaching staff. One thing that stuck out to me, did you guys really play 62 exhibition games in part of your in the lead up to the Olympics? Because that seems like an insane amount of games.
It was, yeah. So we...
Oh, that Herb Brooks.
We were in trains, planes, and automobiles and traveling mostly around North America. You know, we had an early tour that went over to Norway and Finland for a couple of weeks where we played 10 games in about a two-week period. And so it was a grinding type of schedule, but, you know, for us as you know, competitive players that were coming from different colleges and different backgrounds, it was probably the best thing that they could have done with us. My dad did a similar venue and a similar itinerary with his 76 teams. They were actually based out of Madison. And, you know, all the spare equipment, all the things that they were working with was in my garage. And so you'd walk out there, you see all this Olympic stuff and national team stuff and jerseys and socks and equipment bags.
That had to make it even harder for you, having been cut from the team. You're like constantly reminded.
I saw it full throttle. So every day when you go out to the garage, there it is. And so they were running the team out of Madison Ice Arena and, you know, traveling around the country similar to what we did. But yeah, we played a 60-game schedule against NHL teams, American League teams, you know, college teams, and just traveled around and competed and got to know one another, got to develop friendships, you know, try to figure out, you know, who Jack O'Callaghan has, you know, Jim Craig, and this Rizzioni guy. He talks a little funnier than we do from the Midwest, these guys from Boston now with their accent, but that was something that I think needed to be done just to get you know, the team to understand that if we were going to be successful, we had to come together as a group and really become a team. And I think the movie with, you know, your young kids, you know, really relives what happened, you know, so long ago. So that generation that, you know, obviously didn't see it, is growing up, they can throw that in the, you know, the DVD now and watch it and relive it. And that's what I think continues the story on and on. It's sort of like wine. It keeps getting better and better. The stories get better as we get older. And so, yeah, it's pretty cool.
I've got 1,000 questions here. We're going to get to all these, but my mind's spinning 1,000 miles an hour. So we've referenced Miracle, the movie. I know that Hollywood takes some creative license with it, but you also reference you guys going over to Norway and playing, and there's a famous scene in the movie about having to do the conditioning, the suicides after your game. Was that dramatized for the movie, or did that really play out in similar fashion?
No, that was fairly accurate. A couple of things, obviously, they left out or could have added.
Some cuss words maybe that weren't in the movie.
And I think in the movie, you know, they've got us talking about girls up in the stands. That's not accurate. I mean, we're grinding it out, playing like these 10 games in like 14 days. We had no time to do anything else other than get ready for our next game. What it didn't show was that we had to play the same team the next day. And so you can imagine, as we're doing these skating drills, we called them Herbies at the time, we're trying to figure out, because at the end of a game, you're either thirsty or you're hungry, you're both. And, we're trying to figure out how we're going to get back to the hotel, get enough sleep and get enough food in us. So, we're ready to play the next day. But it was fairly accurate. The end of the skating didn't quite happen the way the movie portrayed it. But, it was interesting because at that time we had 26 players on the team and there were 6 players that weren't dressed. So there were 6 players up in the crowd that, trying to figure out what's going on. So when the game ends, usually you shake hands, you're in the locker room, you're showering, you're getting back to your hotel where, Herbie pulled us over. We're trying to figure out what he wanted to do other than the Minnesota players that were on the ice at that time because they figured, they knew what was coming. All the other players, who played for different colleges had no idea what we were doing. Then we started skating. I was like, this guy's nuts. And so the place was packed to watch the game. And so as we were skating, they thought we were like putting on some kind of exhibition. This is what we do. So after about 10 or 15 minutes, all those people decide, well, these guys are, whatever they're doing, I don't care. We're leaving. We're going home. And then the rink manager, after about 20 or 25 minutes, he wanted to go. I'm sure he had a long day. So he turned all the lights off. So we figured, we're done because all you have is now auxiliary lights. And so, we kept skating probably for another 20 minutes. And then we finally got to the end and got back and came back the next day. And I think we won. It was either 8-1 or 9-0. So we understood Herb's message.
I'm saying there's a method to his madness. Huh?
I mean, that had to be a big part of it for you is the transition to playing under Herb. I mean, your dad and him had all that history and the Minnesota-Wisconsin divide. What was that like acclimating to playing for Herb and then eventually kind of, I think he called you in, if I remember right, and basically kind of lifted a weight off your shoulders, I think, as you described.
Yeah, early on in the process, because I didn't know where I was going to stand. Obviously, the year before here at Wisconsin, I had a real strong year. I was college player of the year, so I was confident going on the ice. I just wasn't real confident who was coaching us because at that time, obviously, Minnesota-Wisconsin was one of the prime rivalries in college hockey. It's no love loss that my dad and Herb didn't get along, but I think they both respected each other, obviously had different paths on how they coach. And so I was coming from a guy who, was high energy, positive all the time, irrelevant at what was going on the ice, upbeat, made the game fun to, Herbie, a little bit more dramatic, firm, didn't care about a lot of things that concerned his players, the relationships that maybe a coach and a player has. He wasn't concerned about that. But if you step back and look at Herbie's background and realize in 1960, he was the last guy cut on that hockey team. So when he got cut, there's a story, in Squaw Valley, he calls his dad back in Minneapolis, hey, I just got cut, what should I do? His dad didn't, well, get on the plane and come on home. And so he flew back to, Minneapolis and watched his teammates win a gold medal at Squaw Valley in 1960. So, spring forward, 20 years later, now he's the coach of the team. So, the toughest part of coaching all-star teams or real high-profile players is your ability to bring all of them together. And now as a coach for many years, you can understand the struggles that he had to go through as he was preparing us to get ready to, play in this Olympic Games, and he had 5.5 months to do it. And so whether it was, Mike Arizioni, or whether it was Billy Baker, or was myself, or Kenny Morrow, or these guys that were coming from their respected college teams, where they were the key people. You know, they played the most minutes. They played on the power play. They killed the penalties. They were out there in the last minute of a game if it was tight. They were taking a key face off. And so now you have 20 of these guys. How are you going to distribute those minutes? And is everybody going to buy into those minutes and do those minutes that they have as best they can? And if I can get the group to do that, then I've got a team, then I got a chance to be successful. So, you know, those 60 games we played gave us an opportunity to start filtering through the process of who are going to be key pieces to this group, who are going to be support people, and then working through it and getting everybody to that transition stage where they accept their roles. And the minute people start accepting their roles, then the team has a capability to playing up to their level that they were meant to be, maybe.
One of the exhibition games was against Russia in Madison Square Garden right before the Olympics started.
That wasn't a good one.
Well, what I want to ask is, did you guys play possum a little bit or hold back a little bit in that game? The final score was 10-3, but...
Could have been worse.
Was there a little strategy on maybe not revealing some things?
No, not at all.
No, okay.
If you step back probably about maybe 8 or 9 months, the previous spring in 79, the World Championships were held in Moscow, and Herb was a coach. And actually, Craig Patrick, our assistant coach at the time, was playing on that team. And so Herb decided with that group of players, normally you take NHL players, and you might sprinkle in one or two college players with that group, just depending on who's late in the playoff runs and different things that the NHL players have to deal with. So anyways, there was about a six of us that were on that team and went over to Moscow and played in that world championship for that spring of 79. And so in Moscow, playing against the Russians, and you got all the military and everything.
KGB.
At the game, and yeah. You got, the leaders of their country there. And, for that group of players, you got to see the big boys. You got to see them perform at a real high level. And
How'd that game go?
Those weren't good. Those weren't good because, Russia ended up winning the world championship. But more importantly, it gave those players that were on that team a chance to understand what, the groups that were going into Lake Placid were up against. And so, and I even spring back farther back. My dad coached, three or four or five different world championship teams in the 70s. Had played against the Russians and that elite group for many different times. Didn't have a lot of success. And I remember in 75, world championships were in Dusseldorf in West Germany. And I bought a plane ticket, flew over with my mom, and watched a week of that tournament. A guy by the name of Bud Snyder was playing for the Americans at that time, and ended up playing on our 80 team, but scored a hat trick against the Russians. Unfortunately, the Russians had 13 that day.
Oh.
So
Oh, geez.
For Buzzy, he had a pretty good day. The Americans didn't, but my background was I knew the Russians. I would see it every day when my dad was coaching at Wisconsin, Karmeloff, Petrov, Mikhailov, jerseys.
He studied them pretty intensely.
Very intensely. And so as he was coaching in these world championship games, he's watching Finland, he's watching Sweden, he's watching the Russians, and he's incorporating things that and what he's seeing, and brings back to Wisconsin. He's got this international flavor to the way he's coaching the Wisconsin teams. Instead of this power play, we got the Russian power play, we got the Finn power play, we got the Swede power play. And so people got to understand that they were playing under him. And so my background was quite deep in that. And then, the players got a chance to play in 79. But I springboard now to that game in Madison Square Garden. About half of our team hadn't seen the big club. We had played against some of the Russian B teams and C teams over the course of the winter. We hadn't seen the big boys. And so as we're preparing for that game, two things happen. One is instead of playing, you're actually watching. And, it doesn't take long for them to snap that puck around and, score a goal. And it's like, whoa, did you see that? What a move by Maltsev. Oh, my gosh, if I'm Jimmy Craig, I'm not going to stop that either. The second is if you got through that game, the bus was there. You got to get on the bus, and you were going to Lake Placid. And so you didn't want to get hurt in that game.
Oh, yeah.
Because you were one step away from being and fulfilling that dream of being on that Olympic team. And so if you got hurt in that game, and if depending on your, you know, severity of your injury, you know, that bus door might not be open. In fact, it happened to Jack O'Callaghan that game. He twisted his knee. Yeah. And so, you know, we're all packing our bags. Yeah, we got humiliated. And but, you know, after the shower, you know, hey, we're going to be an Olympian. You know, a couple of days, we're going to be in the Olympics. And so as disappointing as we were in the performance that evening, we were excited to be an Olympic player. And, you know, the last question before we got on the bus was Jack going to be part of that group? He had been with us all year, and all of a sudden, here's this last game you're playing, and all of a sudden, he's got hurt. And so between Herb, our doctors, the medical staff, and the people that, you know, were with us in New York, he wasn't going to be able to start the tournament. So it's like, as a coach, what do you do? But he was part of our family, and he was an important part of our family. If he couldn't play the first two or three, four games, that's okay. He's part of our group, and we needed him. And so they decided that they were going to bring him along. Didn't know when he was going to play or if he was going to play, but it was an important cog to what our group had developed.
So do you think it was, if you were intimidated, I mean, they had to be intimidated to see them. Was that a good thing or a bad thing that you had just seen the Russians before playing them again, that you, because you go into the rematch, if you will, either, oh my gosh, we can't compete with these guys, they're so good, or did that take the edge off? Like, all right, we've seen them. We've seen what they got. Now let's go beat them.
Yeah, it's you know, a couple of things with that is that who were we, you know, 18 to 22 year olds? That was the age of most of the players. We had Mike Rizzioni and Buzzy Snyder were a little bit older, but we were young college players. And, you know, the year before, you know, that team had beaten a group of NHL All-Stars 6-0 in Montreal. So who are we to sit in front of this group and say, oh, yeah, we have a chance to beat them? It's just like, no, I mean, they're going to win the gold medal and everybody else is fighting for everything else. And
so going into that game, you didn't necessarily really believe you could beat them?
Well, what ends up happening is that when we got humiliated in Madison Square Garden.
Humiliated, he says.
Russia, you know, wasn't even on our mind after that because, you know, they weren't on our schedule. We didn't know if we were going to play them or not. We were hoping, you know, the only chance we had to play them was to get in the medal round. They were in a different bracket than we were.
Yeah.
And so in those short tournaments, your focus comes on what's next. Well, the next for us as we're going up to Lake Placid is we're going to play the Swedes the day before the Olympics open up. So we actually played a game before we had our opening ceremonies. And so if you lose that game, you might not get to the medal round. And then, you know, a chance of winning a medal obviously isn't going to happen. So your focus and energy and attention has to be 100% on what's next. You can't get ahead of yourself. And so as we left Madison Square Garden in New York City, no one thought about the Russians. It wasn't even there. I mean, the given was they were going to win the gold medal. We wanted to make sure we played well against Sweden. And in our first period against Sweden in the Olympics, we weren't very good. In fact, I mean, it was crazy. So we go out the first period, and, you know, you're fulfilling this dream now. You got the Olympic jersey on. You, yeah. They're dropping the puck. You're in the Olympics. And we played, well, we didn't play very good at all. And so Robbie McClanahan, my left wing, about halfway through the periods, you know, gets a hip check and has a deep thigh bruise Charlie horse. So we come in at the end of the first period, and Robbie's in the corner. He's got his hockey pants down. He's got a gigantic ice bag on his thigh. We don't think he's going to play again. And so this is a player that Herb coached at Minnesota for the last couple of years. They won a national championship in 79 and with Robbie on the team. So you would think Herbie would have some type of sympathy for him or, you know, figure out with the doctors, is there a chance he can play? Nope. Herbie came in the locker room and, you know, he was disappointed. No, disappointed. He was mad the way we were playing. And so instead of, you know, singling the group out as a whole, his philosophy was to go after somebody. So he looks at Robbie. What's wrong with you? You know, he's got his pants down. He's got this gigantic ice bag on his thigh. You know, he's in tears because, you know, he doesn't know if he's going to be able to play again. What's wrong with you? And he's, you know, doctor steps in. Oh, he's got this. And he says, oh, and then he just starts ranting and raving. He's a player he coached for the last 2 or 3 years. And he goes up and down and totally embarrasses him, humiliates him right in front of the whole group. And spends about 2 or 3 minutes doing that, just does a button hook. And in the movie, I think there's a scene, you know, looks over at Craig Patrick and says, oh, that'll get him going.
Yeah.
And so as he's walking down, Robbie jumps up with the ice bag on his thigh, you know, and you can imagine have a hockey pants on, your skates are still on, you know, you're not going to be able to move to it. He starts jumping after Herb. And, I mean, he starts swearing up and down, this and that. They get to the door that goes out of our locker room. Herb gets there first, obviously, and Robbie's chasing him down the hallway. So I'm sitting next to Arizione, you know, Cal and a couple guys, and it's like, somebody's got to get control of this locker room. I mean, we're 20 minutes into our Olympic experience, and Herbie's lost it.
Oh my gosh.
But we went out and played real well the second period, and Billy Baker scores a big goal at the end of the game to tie it, and that started the momentum. But it didn't start off too good.
So you get a little momentum. Then you get the boost of going through the opening ceremony, right?
Yep. The next day, you're excited because, we ended up tying a game late. So when you do that in our world, the team that ties it usually is quite excited. So instead of losing a game and not knowing what's going to happen the rest of the tournament, we get a point out of the game, which ended up being huge for us. And then the next morning, you get to put all your, opening ceremony gear on, and you get a chance to fulfill that dream of participating in the opening ceremonies. And when you're the host country always comes in last into the stadium.
Yeah.
So everybody's inside there, and, here comes the United States of America with all its, Olympic athletes, and, something that I think a lot of us really cherished.
Okay, let's jump ahead to that Russia game. I got my next question here. So in the movie, and I apologize for referencing the movie so much, it makes me sound uninitiated, but that's my easiest frame of reference, especially as I just watched it. At the end of the first period, you guys are down 2-1, and you score right at the end of the first period to tie the game. In the movie, you're inserted back in the game with like 16 seconds left in the period and score essentially at the buzzer. Did that play out pretty accurately?
I would think most of the goals that they put in the movie are pretty accurate. The interesting thing is that when Kurt Russell decided to do the movie, part of the agreement was that his son, who was a goaltender at the time, and they were living in Colorado and Hollywood back and forth in two different spots, but he also had a place up in Vancouver, in Victoria Island. And so if they were going to do the movie, they had to do it back there because that's where his son, who was a goaltender, was playing junior hockey. Oh. So the movie was actually filmed in Canada. So all those people you see in the crowd were Canadians holding American flags back and forth. And so most of the goals I got were pretty accurate. So there were, Ryan Walter, who was, an NHL player for a long time, was actually the referee in the movie. And so he had the stripes on, and he was also helping with this script as far as portraying and getting as accurately as they could how a goal would score. So every once in a while your phone would ring, hey, this is Ryan Walter, we're on the ice, what were you thinking as you were coming, and so they got the accuracy part of the goals pretty good. And so as you see these goals, that one with 1 second to go, I think Arizioni was coming off the ice, and I jumped on pretty quick, and Davey Christian had the puck coming up, and there's not much time. You figure he's going to shoot the puck into the zone, and all of a sudden, Tretiak puts out a rebound that he normally does, and their defenseman hesitated for a second, which gave me an opportunity to get by him and, put a move on him, and then the puck goes in, and the first thing you're trying to do is look at the clock to see if there's any time left, because there was not that much. And once we, realized that there was time and they were going to count the goal, that's, as I've mentioned many times, the different games throughout the lead up to the medal round, and then the game itself against the Russians, there were things that happened in that game that we needed to happen to keep that momentum going. So instead of going in at the end of the first period down 2-1, now you go in, it's 2-2, and you take a breath, you sit back and say, well, now it's only 40 minutes. That's a lot more manageable than 60 minutes.
Sure.
And rest and say, okay, let's go try to do the same thing the second period. And we probably should have brought up our own puck the second period because the Russians weren't too happy. They had the puck most of that second period. But again, things happened in that second period, that we needed to happen. And, a couple breakdowns, and Jimmy makes some great saves and keeps us in the game. And so, as you get to the end of that period, you're still only down 3-2. Now you're back in the locker room doing the same thing, catching your breath. Well, now it's only 20 minutes, but we need to score next.
Yeah.
And then you do.
And then we do.
We do. Yeah.
That's right.
This is the humble Mark Johnson that people need to know. He scored the goal.
Yeah. So it. We got a power play. 12 or 13 minutes to go in the game, and it wasn't a very pretty power play. It wasn't drawn up that way, but again, you're looking for some kind of bounce or some kind of break or something to happen that gives you a chance to score. And if you look at the Russians' first goal in that game, you know, it was a broken tight play where a pass came across, hit one of our defensemen's skates, jumps right on the stick of the Russian player, puts it in the net, 1-0 Russia. Well, in the third period on the power play, Davey Silk's bringing it down the left side. He's a right-handed stick handler and makes a move to the inside, gets hip checked, puck, you know, comes to the middle of the ice, hits one of their players' skates, bounces right to my stick. Back of the net, you know, 3-3. And now you got a little bit different type of game. So now it's 3-3, and, you know, you got 11 and a half or 12 minutes to go. And, you know, that becomes a lot more manageable than 60 minutes. But yet you're still playing the Russians. And, you know, they can score 3, 4, 5 goals in a heartbeat. And so the nice thing about the next probably minute and a half or 2 minutes, you know, Mike, you know, scores to put us up 4-3. And I always tell people, you know, when I scored to make it 3-3, the place got loud. I mean, like really loud. But when Mike scored, you could feel noise. I mean, it was so loud. And, you know, thank goodness the roof was bolted down because it would have gone right off. That's how loud it got. And so after the celebration, and we seemed for whatever reason in that tournament, every goal we scored, the entire team went on the ice and celebrated that individual's goal. And so when Mike scored, we're all on the ice celebrating. You know, we come back to the bench, and you're catching your breath, and you look up, and it goes, oh, there's 10 minutes to go. Wow, that's a long time.
So where in that 10 minutes did you finally feel like, we're going to win this?
Or did you sense the Russians feeling like, wait, they might lose?
Well, it's interesting. When I was in Hartford, you know, a couple weeks ago, and we were watching that last 10 minutes with Mike and Jimmy and Jeremy Schapp, we did a lot of good things that last 10 minutes as far as defending. Offensively, we weren't doing much, knowing that we needed to defend. What the Russians started to do was uncharacteristic of the way they played. Normally, they were a puck possession team. They would make all kinds of passes. They would go back into their zone just to control the play and the puck, and then, you know, systematically move up the ice and, you know, move the puck. They started to dump the puck in, which you hadn't seen before. And, you know, in the last 7 or 8 minutes, you know, the chances that they were trying to develop, you know, we would block a shot. Kenny Moore would go down and block a shot. Billy Baker would block a shot. We would win a faceoff. We'd get the puck, you know, into the neutral zone and did a lot of good things. I don't think anybody got comfortable, and I think you see it in the movie, and, you know, the last 4 or 5 seconds, the puck comes up to the right of Jimmy Craig. It gets up about halfway, you know, between the goal line and the blue line, and I come across, and I take the puck, and I push it out to the neutral zone, knowing that's going to be it. And then you can start seeing the celebration, and that's probably when everybody finally realized and got comfortable that we're going to win. But up to that point, nah.
I get goosebumps just thinking about it, and I clearly wasn't there. I was 1 year old at the time. There is a rumor that a woman ran onto the ice in part of the celebration. Can you clarify what this rumor is and who that might have been?
Well, the last couple of days, it started yesterday. Somebody texted me a picture of my mom and my, at that time, fiancé in the crowd at Lake Placid. And mom's got this white, furry, I don't know, it almost looks like, I don't know what you would say, hat on. My wife's still got, you know, she's got her cheerleading outfit on, and she's up cheering. And so that's been floating around my phone. It got to her phone, and it's a hilarious picture because, one, we look a lot younger back then, and you start, but no, she was a cheerleader for here in Madison, and, you know, her reaction, you know, in those type of games was no different than, you know, when Wisconsin, you know, won a big football game and here comes the crowd on the field or in a basketball game where you upset a number one team or you do something special. On the court you come.
Right.
Well, in hockey, what do you do? Well, you got to get on the ice.
Storm the ice?
Up over the glass, onto the ice, and look around. Nobody followed her. And so first person she saw was Dave Silk and, you know, gave him a big hug and, it was interesting. that summer we ended up getting married. So one of the presents that we received was this gigantic picture of Dave Silk and my wife Leslie
hugging
after the game. And so,
Did you say when she was out? Were you like, what are you doing out here?
Exactly what I said. What are you doing on out here? So, but I still have to ask her, I'm going to have to do that tonight at dinner, is how'd you get off the ice? I mean, you're not going to go over the boards and there's no way you could climb over the glass and stuff. So I'm going to ask her tonight how she got off the ice, because I still don't know.
So your mom was there. Leslie was there. Your dad wasn't there.
He wasn't there for the Russian game. Nope. He was at that time, you know, obviously coaching Wisconsin here, and they were on the road playing at Colorado College against a team that was coached by Jeff Sauer. Talk about a small world and a small place. And Jeff and at Grant Stenbrook was actually, you know, the assistant coach for Wisconsin at that time, who was the assistant coach with my dad in 1976 when they coached the Olympic team together. And then after the Olympics, Grant came here to Madison. And so they were out there, and they were all trying to convince him that he needed to be in Lake Placid. And, you know, being a coach, being in charge of your team, you know, that's the last thing you want to do is distance yourself or go, we got a game, I got to be there. And so they ended up playing Friday night, and they finally convinced him Saturday to get on a plane to get to Lake Placid.
Saturday, the day in between the semifinal and the gold medal game?
Yep. So he spent Saturday. The one thing about Lake Placid, it's challenging to get
to.
You either
got
to go to Montreal or Plattsburgh or Albany and then drive in the rest of the way up the mountain. And obviously with the Olympics being held, it's going to make it a little bit more challenging to get, you know, because at that time, you know, and still today, there's only two ways to get in Lake Placid. So you come off the highway, and, you know, at that time in 1980, to get the fans and the spectators up there, they had these gigantic parking areas, and they were going to bus people up. And so it's just challenging to get to. Once you get there, it's gorgeous. But he was, you know, of all the people that, you know, have coached hockey or, you know, were part of the hockey community back, you know, in the 70s and early 80s, you know, he understood the Russians better than probably anybody because he had coached against them. He studied them. You know, Tarasov, who was the, you know, the one of the founders of Russian hockey, you know, was over in Colorado Springs in the early 60s for a world championship that was held at the Broadmoor. My dad coached at CC for 3 years. And just, you know, as a typical coach, you're studying other coaches and other countries and how they play and things you like and things you take away from them. So very instrumental. But, you know, he ended up getting to our game Sunday morning against.
How did he get there? I mean, it's not like now where you just go on your phone and rent a car.
No, he just, you know, he was fortunate. You know, you got Denver, which is a fairly decent-sized airport, so, you know, drive up from Colorado Springs, get to Denver, and then, you know, Denver, you can get to New York, you get to Boston. I mean, you can make your way. I think he ended up getting there, you know, at the wee hours of the morning Sunday, because the game was at 11 o'clock.
11 a.m.
11 a.m., wow. And so it's, you know, planes, trains, and you know, he ended up arriving. I don't know how much sleep he had, but as I told, you know, some people before that, you know, when we ended up winning against Finland, he was probably one of the most excited people just from the standpoint of he knew how hard it was to do what we did. And he knew the impact of the Russian game. You know, he had faced him so many times and coached against him so many times. And unfortunately, he wasn't able to witness it firsthand, somebody beating the Russians in that setting. But he got to see the celebration and he got to be part of what we did Sunday morning.
What did it mean for you to have him there, though? Because I read a quote that you had given, I think at the time, about telling your teammates, I have 20 minutes left. Like, you were exhausted by the time you got to the third period of that gold medal game. Yeah. You said it was like, I have 20 minutes left. I don't have 20 minutes and 1 second. I've got 20 minutes. So what kind of boost was it to have him in the building?
I think it was just, for me, it was enjoyable just because I knew he was going to enjoy it. And, you know, I saw firsthand, you know, what he had done the last, you know, 10 or 15 years as far as coaching and, you know, winning championships and coaching Olympics, coaching in world championship games. And just the pride and love he had, you know, for the game of hockey and the excitement that, you know, we created and that he saw firsthand Sunday. I think, you know, not only as him being my father, but more importantly, him being, you know, a hockey coach that it experience the other side of what he was seeing in his Olympic experience. But I think for all of us, you know, and most of us had family members there, that's what makes it special, because, you know, we take these cell phones, you take these computers, you take all that way we communicate now and how quickly information travels, not only in our circle, but around the world. We had none of that. And so there was no idea outside of this small little community of a couple thousand people what was going around. I mean, anywhere. We had no idea. I mean, like zero.
Well, one scene in the movie, and again, tell me if this is true or not, as you're walking out of the locker room, there are telegrams and handwritten notes taped all over the walls, and the guys are tapping them as they come out. Was that true, and what were those? Where did they come from?
That was the only communication that we got a sense to see and feel, because as the tournament was going on, the mailman would bring in a bag of mail, you know, either every day or every other day. I mean, a big bag of it. And, you know, you'd open it up and it had all these telegrams on them. And, you know, you started reading the different things that were coming from different parts of the United States, you know, throughout North America and all over the world. As we got to the Russian game, it wasn't one bag, it was multiple bags. And so somebody decided to put them on the outside of our locker room. And so all of a sudden, you know, what was a white wall now was yellow because it had so many of these telegrams. And, you know, you start reading them, you know, from Afghanistan, from Iran, you know, from a lot of different soldiers that were stationed all over the world, just showing their support and understanding, you know, what we were doing and how important it was to them. But that's the only sense we got of any kind of communication, because you can imagine, I mean, we were in a cocoon. And, you know, you get up one day, you practice, you get up the next day, you play a game. And then these things are happening. And, you know, after the Russian games, it was pretty crazy just because the city started to have this energy that we weren't ready for. And I don't think the city was ready for, because there was this buzz, you know, that was happening that was just mind-boggling.
Do you have any idea what happened to those telegrams or any of the artifacts from that? Like, that would be amazing yeah. if those were restored somewhere.
Yeah, that would be, I have no idea.
I mean, you talk about the lack of communication. I mean, the game, the biggest event going on in the world was on tape delay that night on TV. People didn't even get to watch it live other than the small group that was in the arena. Did you go and watch it that night, sort of as the rest of the world was watching it and finding out? Did you watch that broadcast?
We did, you know, on Saturday when we were, you know, our practice, you know, there was the buzz going around that our game time was going to be, well, I shouldn't say that, actually Friday, as we were getting ready for the Russian game, there was a buzz going around that the ABC wanted to change the game time to prime time to 7 or 7:30. And so, you know, there was a little bit of hesitance. We didn't know if we were going to play at the scheduled time or it was going to get bumped back. But then the Olympic committee came in and said, no, schedule set as is. And so
that's funny, nowadays that would never happen.
No, TV would be instantly moved to prime time. Yep. And so back then they didn't change it. And so, you know, after the game, you know, you can imagine what our locker room was like, what the hallway was like, you know, what the city street, I mean, it's one main drag in Lake Placid and you got, you know, the world there. And so it's just a lot of buzz going on. I ended up getting picked for doping, so I had to go sit down. It took me an hour and a half to get what I needed to get done.
Dope testing. Let's clarify. You didn't get picked for doping.
And
it's doping always, control. Yeah. Yes.
It's always interesting, you know, in those settings, like they say, they randomly pick people.
Yeah.
And so
quickly, I had two goals
that game. I said, okay, now who's going to get picked? And so out of a hat, your name comes. And so... But again, that was a unique experience because I went down there, and obviously there's two Russian players in there, and one happened to be Karmaloff. And I mean, I've seen Karmaloff jerseys. I've known Karmaloff's name since I was, you know, in high school, just because, you know, my dad being part of that group that coached against him, and he was an elite player. And now, you know, we're elbow to elbow waiting to get
moments after you beat him.
Moments after we beat him. And that was really surreal. After the game, you know, most of the families, you know, they were living up on top of the hill in Lake Placid, and across the street from where they were bunked out in this gigantic house. And there were probably, I don't know, most of the families had, it was a gigantic house, and they were bunking in and hanging out and cooking together and just having a wonderful time. But across the street was a Holiday Inn, and so they had the game on tape delay. So most of us went over there to watch the game again to make sure we won. So we weren't quite sure that we were in this, you know, fantasy world where we're all dreaming at the same time. But we got to the end of the game and we won again. So it was quite exciting.
One thing that wasn't depicted in the movie that I read about was the team singing God Bless America in the locker room after the game.
Yep.
Did that happen?
Yep, that happened.
Spontaneously? How did that start? Why?
I don't know why things start, but most of us, you know, and I wasn't part of it, the group went down into a separate locker room at that time, and, you know, the president was on the phone. He wanted to talk to
Jimmy Carter.
Yeah, they wanted to talk to us. And so, you know, Mondale was actually at the event, so, you know, we're down there in this room after this game, and, you know, there's a, you know, getting a call from the president and just, you know... Those things you don't prepare for. There's no script when you're getting ready to go to the rink that, you know, after the game, here's what's going to happen. These are the things that are going to happen. So we got our wake-up call the next day, Saturday, when we came to practice because Herd was not only a little grumpy, he was ornery and miserable and very unhappy.
Was he calculated? I mean, so was he, do you think he was really grumpy? Or was he like, I need to be grumpy because I need to get these kids down off their high and get them locked in for the championship?
Yeah, I'm sure as he was getting, you know, taking the bus from the Olympic Village over to practice, you know, how am I going to get these guys' attention? What do I need to do as the leader of this group, as the head coach, to get them to understand that, you know, what they did yesterday was special. It's never going to be forgotten. But what's more important is what they're going to do tomorrow at 11 o'clock. So the turnaround's not very long. You know, in less than 24 hours, you're going to be on the ice playing for a gold medal, knowing that if you win, the medal's yours. Our destiny in controlling it was ours. We had the complete control of it, and the only time in the tournament up to that point that we controlled our destiny. And so it's a special feeling knowing that if you're successful, you're going to get rewarded. But it's also a little nerve-wracking that if you screw up, you're going to see the other end of it. So as the head coach and the leader, that's what's going through his mind. And so, you know, he chose to be firm, to be you know, I wouldn't say grumpy, but just be in a position to get us to understand what happened yesterday is history. What's more important is what's going to happen tomorrow.
So what's to you, what is the legacy of that team and what you guys were able to accomplish in Lake Placid? Because so many people have gone on from that team to do big things. I mean, you've had the chance to coach in the Olympics yourself, to coach the U.S., and it just meant so much to so many people in the country. What do you think the legacy of that group is?
Well, I think, you know, any moment, you know, that stands out, as long as this one is stands out, you know, there's circumstances and things that were going on during that event that really magnified it. So, you know, as people look back at, you know, in the 79, 80, 81 era, you know, there weren't a lot of things that people were smiling about, you know, as they went about their everyday business, whether they were going to work or whether they were going to school. I mean, there just wasn't a lot of things that people were excited about, weren't smiling about. And then for whatever reason, you know, 20 guys got planted in, you know, in Olympic Games and, you know, are going against, you know, an opponent that if you played them 10 times, they would beat you 9. And, you know, people got to witness it. People got to see it. And it just made people smile at a time where they weren't smiling. So, you know, the stories that we've, you know, been told, the stories that people have shared with us, you know, complete strangers hugging at airports and in restaurants and all kinds of different venues just to celebrate this hockey game. And so as we look back on it, I mean, you're very fortunate and you're humbled that you were part of this special group. But to me, more importantly, is it gave... not only a group of players something special, not only a community of hockey, you know, people something to be, you know, smile about, but it gave a country for a brief moment a chance to pause and celebrate.
Mark, thanks for indulging us with the story hour. That I can't get enough of it. And thank you for walking us down memory lane. And good luck this weekend.
Thank you.
With your Lady Badgers. Go win that WCHA title and good luck the rest of the way.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
That could have gone on for another hour.
Easily. I have a whole list of questions we didn't even get to.
Yeah, that was cool. That was cool for me. Tyler and Austin, my sons, are going to listen. I'm going to make them listen to that now as a follow-up from the movie. What else is great is the men's basketball program trending in the right direction. Three in a row. Now they got a win over Purdue on Tuesday night at the Kohl Center. They're playing really well at home, no doubt. And maybe they're starting to find their groove overall, too, that there's been some roster continuity that has had to develop this season, playing without Potter, now without King. And maybe they're trying to find that rhythm now a little bit. It seems like they're starting to do that.
Yeah, you've seen the starting lineup get adjusted based on matchups and who the Badgers are going against. But you're right, there is continuity there. You really like how Aleem Ford is rounded into a more consistent player and somebody that they can count on.
Seemingly. Scoring, rebounds, defense, yeah, he's contributing in a lot of ways.
Right. I've talked a little bit about, in previous episodes, Demetric Trice and becoming a more complete point guard. I mean, he's got 35 assists in the last six games. Really like how he's distributing the ball.
You've seen, too, there's different guys. And this is what I thought Wisconsin's script would be this year, that they would have different guys contribute. And you don't need all seven or eight guys to be hot on the same night. You just need a couple.
As they were reining in threes early in that game against Purdue, all I could think was, okay, here's Patrick and what he was talking about all in the lead up to the season. This team's got a bunch of shooters.
Three straight games with at least 10 three-pointers in them. And so in the last seven games, they've had six different players lead them in scoring. So that's kind of what I mean, that they only have one player averaging in double figures on the year, and that's Nate Reavers. This balance that if you can get two or three guys to have big nights like Davison did at Nebraska, where he hits eight threes and scores 30 points, they're dangerous.
I think you can look at the Purdue game, and you've got Micah Potter, who's become a key cog to this whole machine, going over in the points column, and the Badgers can still find a way.
They still score 69, right, yeah.
To almost hit 70, win that game. To me, that was an encouraging sign.
So another encouraging sign, boy, what a great revelation it is to have a good free throw shooting team again. Last year, that was obviously one of the sore spots. They shot just 65% as a team, 333rd in the country. This year, they're shooting almost 77%. Go 8 for 8 in the final 28 seconds of that game to put it away. And I'm not sure any of those eight free throws hit the rim.
No, and that was a big takeaway for me from that win is, like I said, the threes were falling early. And any team's going to look good and have a chance to win when you're hitting shots consistently from the outside.
Right.
But late in the game, when that dried up and the Badgers had to get really gritty, and part of that was offensive rebounds, which was a story the other way against Purdue the first time these teams met, the Badgers were able to get some timely offensive boards, five of them down the stretch. And while they didn't probably convert as many second chance points off those as you would like, they were able to milk a lot of the clock away and keep the ball out of Purdue's hands, because Purdue was scoring down the stretch, but the Badgers were able to match that with what you talked about, the strong showing on the free throw line down the stretch. I mean, they went 19 for 20 on the game.
Yeah, I think so being truthful here, I think the coaching staff and the players would acknowledge that they need to find ways to still get field goals late in the game so they don't score a field goal for the last 5.5 minutes of that. And yes, they're bleeding clock, and they need to find that mix of running the clock, running these long possessions to when you have a lead like you do, but still trying to attack and still trying to find a way to get high percentage.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that it was the strategy was to bleed the clock. I'm just saying that was the effect of extending those possessions.
But I also think when you have a lead, you're trying to bleed clock.
Purdue was eating into that lead. So yes, a 5.5 minute stretch at the end of the game without a field goal, not a winning scenario usually.
Right.
But the fact that the Badgers were able to show some grit and do some other things, whether it was extending those possessions or getting it done at the free throw line, is encouraging, because teams are, especially as you get into postseason play, you're going to have to find different ways to win tight games.
Yeah, that's a big win for Wisconsin, because Purdue has kind of had their number over the last few years. Purdue is they're a good program. They're well coached. They're solid. I remember in the locker room after the game, Pritzel and Guard were talking about how Purdue might be the toughest team to guard in the league. With the sets that they run and the way that they play their offense, they're difficult. Not just matchup based, but the way they're coached and the way they play, they're really good. So Wisconsin got spanked in West Lafayette earlier the year. They flipped the tables, they get that one at home. That's a big win, because now maybe Wisconsin's starting to separate a little bit here, and the Big Ten, which has been this murky middle and still continues to be to some degree, but now you're 9-6 and you're certainly in that top half of the league with opportunities to be climbing.
That's what I was going to say. Separate as much as any team can right now in this league.
Yeah, because, separate. I mean, separate. There's a five-way tie for third. I didn't separate anything.
Five-way tie for third place, which, hey, you want to be in that mix. But Penn State takes a loss. You know, they're only a game ahead of that five-team pack. And then you've got Maryland is the team that really has separated a little bit at 12-3. But Maryland's got a tough stretch here down the final
everybody
five games
does.
Of the season.
And look, everybody does. I mean, I'm telling you, like, I have no idea what's going to happen the rest of the way from record-wise.
Part of me with the chaos and wanting to some of those seeds of chaos, I like the idea of that dream of the five or six lost Big Ten champions still being in play.
So there's a great Twitter follow, Bart Torvik, who is an analytics guy.
Yeah.
And he's a UW alum. And he's a great follow on Twitter. And he posted this yesterday or 2 days ago about how Wisconsin could still win the Big Ten title outright and all of the scenarios that need to happen is a list of like 30 games of what needs to happen. So first of all, the three on Tuesday night, those all hit. Those all happened the way they did.
Ah, so the dream is still alive.
The dream
is
still alive
me.
For an outright championship. He even has Wisconsin losing another game and still winning the outright championship. He's got Maryland losing five more times. And you look
So you're talking about a seven-loss Big Ten champion in that scenario.
Yes, Wisconsin wins that outright at seven losses. The dream is still alive. So if you're in rooting interest and you want to know the next games, so on Wednesday, Michigan at Rutgers, root for Michigan. Indiana at Minnesota, root for Minnesota. And then on Thursday, Ohio State at Iowa, root for Iowa. Michigan State at Nebraska, you can root for Michigan State. So he doesn't even have unreasonable things necessarily. Oh, Michigan State has to beat Nebraska. No, it's funny to go back and look at it. This gives you your who you need to root for the next like 3 weeks of the season, other than Wisconsin.
Don't get me wrong. I am pulling for the Badgers to find a way to win the title, of course. But the very real scenario of trying to get that double bye for the Big Ten tournament is right there in play.
Maybe more realistic expectations. Yeah. And that's huge to be able to play start on Friday, the Big Ten tournament. If they can get this team to have a top four finish in this league this year, when it's as deep maybe as it's ever been, and there's all this talk about how it's by far the greatest conference in the country, if this team can get a top four finish, you got to start putting Greg Gard in the Coach of the Year conversation. And I know Dan Dockich referenced it on the broadcast. Pat Chambers at Penn State's done a heck of a job. So is Pikel at Rutgers. But Wisconsin might not have a first second team All Big Ten player. Reavers, he might get second team. I hope he does.
No, you're
might
right.
Might depend on where Wisconsin finishes in the standings, but he might be a third team player, and this team might get a top four, top three finish.
You look down the list of good players in this league this year, and you're right. That's going to be a tough team to crack, even for a guy like Nate Reavers.
So up next, Wisconsin plays Rutgers at home on Sunday. They've played really well in day games. Haven't lost. Knock on some wood here. They haven't lost in a day game this year. It's another team where they lost on the road too. They can settle the score here. And it's a similar script. They need to flip what they did. Much like against Purdue, Wisconsin got beat up physically against Rutgers. And I remember after the game, Coach Gard in the locker room, he kind of challenged his team. That was the last game before Micah Potter was eligible. And he challenged their toughness, both mentally, physically, like, can you compete in this league? That was a December game. That was a long time ago when they played at Rutgers. And he took them to task a little bit. Like, I don't know if you guys are tough enough to compete. We need to see that. We need to find that. And I would say that they are answering that.
You've seen the toughness for sure.
This is, if anything, this is a tough and gritty team. And so now they get a chance to kind of come back from that. They got out rebounded handily. They got a rebound in the offensive glass. They had a lot of turnovers, got beat up inside. Chance to, again, avenge an earlier loss.
You're talking about flipping some trends there. There's one trend I would like to see continue, and that is the fact that Rutgers, which is 17-0 at home, is 1-6 on the road this year.
And Wisconsin 12-1 at home.
Exactly. Yeah. So let's see those things continue.
Okay, what else is going on in Wisconsin sports, Brian?
Big week for women's swimming and diving. Beta Nelson, star of that team, she's going for a three-peat at the Big Ten Championships this week in Iowa City. She has won the 100 and 200 backstroke in each of the last two meets. She's been the swimmer of the championships each of the last two meets. So this is her final Big Ten Championships, looking to three-peat in those two events.
Verona's own, Beta Nelson.
That's right.
Is she an Olympian? Will she be competing for the Olympics this coming up this summer?
She will certainly contend, the Olympic trials.
She'll be at the trials?
For sure.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, it's hard to paint anybody onto the Olympic team. I mean, the U.S. is pretty much the pinnacle of world swimming,
she'll
or at
be
least
in the
right there.
In the swimming. Yeah. Okay, so the home, there's a lot of events where folks can come see some of our seniors for the last time, too. We got a lot of events coming this weekend, starting with wrestling. Then Wisconsin ranked number 4 in the country in wrestling. Come out to the Fieldhouse Thursday night, 8 p.m. it's a cool environment to see Wisconsin wrestling. Our marketing staff has done a really good job of trying to make that an event and cool lighting and everything. And they'll be honoring their seven seniors, including Eli Stickley, who passed away tragically in a car accident. They'll still recognize him. This would have been his senior day. So wrestling will be at home. Come check them out.
Don't forget to mention they're going against Northern Iowa, which is a traditionally strong wrestling program. Just wanted to throw that in there. Just make sure that gets noted.
You work at Wisconsin now, Brian.
I'm not saying I'm cheering for them. Just saying. Adds to the intrigue.
Wisconsin women's basketball has their senior day on Saturday. They play Northwestern, a ranked team. Last chance to see the seniors for them. Men's hockey wraps up their home slate against number 10 Arizona State. When you think hockey, you think Arizona State. But they're really good. They're number 10 in the country. They play them on Friday and Saturday at 7 p.m. Be a good environment at the Kohl Center, hopefully. So lots of ways to check out the Badgers this weekend. Lots of final ways to check out our seniors. Thank you for listening to our podcast, our long podcast today. But if you made it till the end, you are a true friend of the pod. So appreciate it. We will we'll do this again next week.
Unless we get fired. You're a true friend of the pod.
'Thank you for listening to Behind the Badgers. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your preferred podcast platform. The preceding has been a Learfield IMG College presentation.